Christmas falls on a weekend this year, chance for many families to curl up with a good film that stood the test of holidays past. But what if you've already seen It's a Wonderful Life and Bad Santa? What's left? Cameron Crowe joins us now from Los Angeles. Mr. Crowe is the esteemed screenwriter and director whose films include Say Anything, Almost Famous, Jerry Maguire, the documentary Pearl Jam 20, and the just-released We Bought a Zoo, starring Ben Affleck's best friend. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Crowe.
Good to be with you, Scott. Happy holiday to you, sir.
And happy holiday to you as well. Now, I've gotten a sneak peek at your list. First, Home Alone, the John Hughes, Chris Columbus. Can I call it a classic from 1990?
I think we can call it a classic.
How could we do this? We forgot him.
We didn't forget him. We just miscounted.
What kind of mother am I?
If it makes you feel any better, I forgot my reading classes.
Kevin McAllister's family goes away for the holidays. They inadvertently leave him behind. Joe Pesci, Daniel Stern are the bad guys. Catherine O'Hara is the funny mother. Why is it on the list?
I started sharing this movie, Scott, with my two little boys. They're 11 now. And they started wanting to see it over the holiday. And I've watched them kind of grown up and be more discerning as movie watchers, to the point where one of them now says, "Dad, that one scene with Kevin is out of tone with the rest of the movie." I'm like, whoa, what am I raising here? But I like that the movie casts its own spell. And for me, that's everything in a Christmas movie. If there's something in the air that lingers when it's over. And the great thing about Home Alone is it's a tight, funny story. And it doesn't hit you over the head with the holidays. The holidays just kind of slip in to the story in a really seamless way.
But of course, at the heart of the story is Kevin's discovery that that old man Marley is, I hope I give nothing away, is really kind of nice.
You can say hello when you see me. You don't have to be afraid. There's a lot of things going around about me, but none of it's true. Okay? Been a good boy this year?
I think so.
You swear to it?
No.
And that's really one of the parts of the movie that takes it to that other level.
Second film on your list is A Christmas Carol. Now, there have been so many versions. You recommend the 1984 version that was made for television. And it got some great British actors, including Susanna York and Frank Finlay and Roger Rees. But George C. Scott, the one American, plays Scrooge.
These are garments, Mr. Cratchit. Garments were invented by the human race's protection against the cold. Once purchased, they may be used indefinitely for the purpose for which they are intended.
I just think it's one of the great George C. Scott performances. It's a little bit a lost treasure. They did not put that out on DVD for a long time. The people who see that version of Christmas Carol tend to really treasure it and make everybody crowd around and watch it. And it's just kind of a hard-nosed, sentimentality-light version of the story.
But is this kind of Scrooge is more like Patton than like other versions that we've seen?
He's just in a very bad mood.
Coal is momentary and coal is costly. There will be no more coal burnt in this office today. Is that quite clear, Mr. Cratchit?
Yes, sir.
Now, please get back to work before I am forced to conclude that your services are no longer required.
He does seem extraordinarily cranky. And I love it for that.
Third film on your list, one of my favorites, a great Billy Wilder 1960 film, The Apartment. And Christmas, because the pivotal scene, or at least the storyline, kind of begins at a Christmas Eve party.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you. I thought you were avoiding me.
What gave you that idea?
In the last 6 weeks, you've only been in my elevator once, and you didn't take off your hat.
Well, as a matter of fact...
Company party. Jack Lemmon has got a crush on Shirley MacLaine, who's the elevator operator. And she's having a cheerless extramarital affair with the head of the company, played by Fred McMurray, before he was America's dad. And he lets his apartment out for that purpose. Why did you choose this film?
Just even as you describe the movie, I get a little thrill. It's just a great setup. It's one of Billy Wilder's tightest, most modern, and ultimately timeless movies. But it's set in that beautiful time between Christmas and New Year's. And again, he doesn't hit you over the head with the easy sentimentality of the season. What he does is pushes against it. There's one of the great all-time movie Santas in this movie and watch for it. Because when this Santa pops up in a scene with Jack Lemmon, you are watching Christmas done in the unique Billy Wilder way.
Hey, Charlie, give me a shot of bourbon and step on it. My sleigh is double parked.
It's a drunken Santa at a bar.
Chinese restaurant bars, I remember.
Yeah. He uses the Santa to remind you of the season and the loneliness of the season and that happy, sad feeling we all sometimes experience, not particularly as intensely as C.C. Baxter in The Apartment, played by Lemmon, but it's such a thrilling comedy and so much fun to watch during the holidays.
Do these films remind you what is really to treasure in a good holiday film?
Yeah, I think I like a good, happy, sad, warm feeling that's bracing and clear-eyed in its optimism. Because you're kind of facing the future, you're thinking about the past, it's everything's in play.
Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you.
Uncle Ebenezer, this is my wife, Janet.
And I come for three reasons. First, to beg your pardon for the things I said about Christmas. Secondly, I've come to meet your wife.
Well, here she is.
And a very beautiful woman she is, too.
Thank you.
Thirdly, if the invitation to dine with you today is still in force, I accept.
Of course it's still in force. Hurrah!
You love a Christmas movie that gives you a little music, a little magic, and also that little sense of a nudge at your shoulder that we've been through a lot this year. I dig that feeling.
Tell us, Cameron, about your latest film, We Bought a Zoo.
They told me early on We Bought a Zoo was going to come out on December 23rd. And I immediately started thinking about, oh boy, this is a Christmas release. So I really went for it when we were filming it. I wanted it to feel kind of like those holiday Bruce Springsteen concerts where Bruce would take a pause and start to tell you this story about growing up in New Jersey, and Roy Bittan would be playing piano behind him, and he'd give you this kind of yarn about, I came home late, my dad is at the table, and I knew I had the big man in the band, but what am I going to tell my dad who doesn't want me to play rock and roll? And you know, it's like, you just feel warm to your soul.
Cameron, thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Cameron Crowe, speaking from Los Angeles. Schools across the country are on break this week, meaning that millions of students don't have to think even about algebra. Are they just missing the algebra that's all around them? Joined now by our math guy, Keith Devlin of Stanford University, who joins us this week from member station KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Keith, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott. Nice to be here.
Well, nice to join us electronically. I bet you're pretty happy you're in Boulder for the holidays, though, aren't you?
That's right. I came out here for a white Christmas, and right now it looks as though we're getting one.
Oh, all right. Now, I think a lot of people think of algebra as kind of arithmetic with letters. You say that's wrong.
That's right. Arithmetic with the letters is still arithmetic. Algebra is actually a very different way of thinking. With arithmetic, you actually take some numbers and you calculate a new number. With algebra, you think about numbers. You end up naming an unknown number. You call it X or Y. And then you reason not arithmetically so much as logically. So algebra is really logical thinking about numbers as opposed to arithmetic, which is calculating with numbers. And in fact, it's because people, I think, when kids don't realize it's a different way of thinking, that they find algebra so hard, because they try to solve algebra problems using arithmetic, and it doesn't work.
Well, why was algebra invented? And I recognize it may not have been invented by just one person, but what need in the world was being addressed when algebra was created?
What we think of as algebra, and it goes back into the ancient Babylonians and the Greeks, but it was really in the Muslim Empire in the 9th and 10th centuries where it really developed. In fact, there was one particular individual called Al-Khwarizmi who wrote a textbook in the 9th century which essentially lays out modern algebra. It wasn't symbolic. He wrote it out entirely in words because he was actually telling stories about how to reason with number. He was trying to describe to people how to think logically about numbers in this method called algebra. But that book that he wrote not only established modern algebra, but it also gave it its name. The name algebra is an Arabic term, al-jabra. He also wrote a book on arithmetic, how to do calculations with numbers, and that's why we have this word algorithm. You take Al-Khwarizmi and it becomes algorithm for rules, procedures for doing numerical calculations.
And was this done to assist the trading for which the Mideast was the centre of the world then?
Yeah, in fact, one of the things that's typical of the work done in mathematics in the 9th, 10th, 11th century in the Arabic-speaking world is they were not interested in theorising. They were very practical people, and they developed algebra to be more efficient traders, more efficient commercial people, to be better engineers. In fact, Baghdad in the 9th century is the equivalent of Silicon Valley in the 20th century, in the 21st century. That was the centre of new technologies for many centuries as a result of developing that algebra.
How do you package this story for students these days?
It's very difficult, actually, because the revolutions, both in arithmetic and then later algebra, were so pervasive and so fundamental that once people got used to it, what had been regarded as this brilliant breakthrough was regarded as dull and routine. We see it today with technologies. Mm-hmm. To me, the iPad, the iPhone, those are incredible breakthroughs. But to anybody under the age of 15 or 16, that's just part of life. It's no big deal for kids when they have these things. And that's a measure of how fundamental a major change is.
Keith, do you think schools sometimes make a mistake in the way they try and convey algebra to students?
Well, I think they make a terrible mistake. First of all, students typically will ask this question, what is it useful for? And if a child is asking that, then it's been introduced in the wrong way. I think it would be much more effective to begin with a bit of the history. Why did people develop this stuff? Algebra didn't come in, it wasn't just sort of discovered hidden in a box somewhere. People invented it to solve real-life problems. Now, in the 9th century, people literally had to solve those problems themselves with a paper and pencil. Today, we literally don't have to use algebra because we have devices in our pockets, we have spreadsheets on our computers that implement the algebra for us. But we are actually better users of technologies when we have some idea of what goes on underneath the hood.
Keith, I hope you all have a wonderful holiday.
And the same to you, Scott.
Our math guy, Keith Devlin, speaking with us from Boulder, Colorado this week. There's a Purple Heart in the window of the AZ Outlet pawn shop in Holland, Michigan, right between a silver necklace and an inexpensive watch. Brian Vandenbosch says a young man walked into his shop just before Thanksgiving to pawn a medal that the U.S. government awards to soldiers who've been wounded or killed in action. He says he doesn't know why the young man needed or wanted to pawn his medal. He did say a couple of things, like he won two of these in Afghanistan, but I didn't ask. Doing what or how, it's not for me to ask, Mr. Vandenbosch told us. He also won't say how much he paid him for the Purple Heart. I don't talk about that, he says. He needed a little to get by, so I helped him. Brian Vandenbosch says he will not sell that Purple Heart. He put the medal in his window to honor men and women in the military. People in Holland, Michigan noticed. They started calling. They didn't want to buy it, says Mr. Vandenbosch. They just wanted to help the guy. I said, don't worry, I'm not selling it to anyone. Now, there's much that's unknown in this story. What would lead a man to pawn a Purple Heart? Was he down on his luck, sickened by war? Do we even really know that the Purple Heart was his, or something that he inherited, found, or even filched? But Brian Vandenbosch knows that pawn shops are lenders of the last resort. He said that people come in to pawn things they've loved because they're short of cash and need to see a doctor, buy shoes, or pay for a funeral. There is a story behind each item in his store, the hocked wedding ring or set of earrings, the toy ones held by a child who's now gone away, or the watch inscribed Love Forever that sold when love or money have run out. People who come in here aren't having a good day, he says. They're often having problems and are a little embarrassed. I don't add to that. The story of the Purple Heart in the pawn shop window reminds us that to truly help people, you don't need to do worthy things like go to Bangladesh or set up a 501(c) corporation. Look at your neighbors, says Brian Vandenbosch. Look at people all around you. You've got friends, I'll bet, who can use some help, paying for food or gas to get to their job. If you really want to help people, you don't have to look very far. This is a time of year when extended families get together, catch up on family news, eat, celebrate, and for many, to talk politics. With the 2012 presidential election on the horizon, NPR's Debbie Elliott made a stop in Camden, South Carolina, to during our recent Hard Times road trip to hear what was on the minds of the close-knit Gaither James family. Like other African Americans who are considered a part of President Obama's political base, they're concerned about the economy and today's political climate.
Members of Camden Second Presbyterian Church recently gathered after Sunday service for a special meal.
And another spoon for macaroni.
The parish house kitchen is a flurry of activity. Longtime church members and sisters, Ernestine James Adams and Althea James Truett, are gathered around the table where Truett is using an electric knife to carve her famous ham. Adams takes a little sample. The sisters, in their late 70s, have deep roots at Second Presbyterian. Their grandfather was a founding member when the church was established in 1893. Their father, the town's blacksmith, was an elder. As a boy, he attended the church's school, back then the only option for African Americans. On this Sunday evening, Ernestine Adams welcomed several of their cousins to the parish house, telling them what they missed earlier.
You should have been there, Dwight. Mm. That food was out of sight. I'll tell you.
Dwight James is the sister's second cousin and is the state director of the NAACP. He and his wife, Deborah, have 17-year-old twins who will soon be heading off to college in these uncertain times.
It's a difficult forecast for any of us right now because of the state of the economy.
South Carolina has a 10.5% unemployment rate. James is hopeful that a good education will provide opportunities for his sons, just like it's done for generations of the James family. Ernestine Adams and her sister, Althea Truett, both have PhDs. They had distinguished careers in the Northeast and moved back home to Camden to retire. They say it's a different place than when they were growing up, but with some of the same issues, namely lingering racism. The same thing Truett says that's holding the nation back right now.
How can we not carry on a conversation about the state of America without talking about racism?
You know, we need to have this conversation and move on.
That's William Gaither, another cousin.
Well, we can't move on because there is no truth and no reconciliation.
Gaither is recently retired from the South Carolina Department of Employment and Workforce. He doesn't agree with the theory that America moved into a post-racial era when President Obama was elected. Neither does Ernestine Adams.
That's sort of like a cave for hiding.
Adams says denying racism keeps the country from reaching its full economic potential.
You know, a lot of what we are experiencing will not go away until we admit the most outstanding and devastating problem in this country. And it is that people are treated differentially only because they are of a different color.
Her cousin, educator Ann Gaither Cureton, says even President Obama doesn't get the respect he should as president because of the color of his skin.
From South Carolina, a representative to yell out should be decorum. You lie to the president and not be chastised by that?
She's referring to Republican Congressman Joe Wilson, who was rebuked by the U.S. House for the outburst during the president's speech to a joint session of Congress in 2009. Cureton says some Republicans would rather see President Obama fail than the nation prosper. Dwight James thinks that reflects the near toxic political climate today.
It's race, and then it's power. It's control.
The class power.
They don't want to concede that to any other institution, person, or party. She tagged the Republicans. But there are also some Democrats own some of this
absolutely.
As well. There's a group of people in Congress who don't want to share power.
The relatives here don't necessarily agree with some critics on the left who say President Obama hasn't done enough to help the poor and disenfranchised. They say he's done a good job given the obstacles he inherited, the economy, wars abroad, the housing crisis, and now an uncooperative Congress. Althea Truett.
He has had to go down that lonely road alone And I admire and respect the fact that it has not knocked the fight out of him, that he wants to run again. I think I would say, to hell with it, you can have it.
Truett believes the country can recover, but with the unemployment rate in the African American community disproportionately high, the family members here agree there are challenges ahead for the next generation. Deborah Grant James, the mother of the twin teenagers, says what's interesting is to look at the world through their eyes.
To them, capitalism trumps racism. They don't consider that because I'm a black man or a black male, I'm going to be limited. No, they want to compete with whomever is out there.
But they have learned some lessons, she says, like the time one son had the highest average but was passed over for an academic honor that went instead to a white student. They later learned the parents of the winner had donated money to the school.
Instead of taking the adopting the opinion that because he is black, he was discriminated against, he saw it more that the money, because they had the power, he lost.
But it's both.
It is both.
It is both.
This is why. It is both, because racism is embedded in capitalism.
Controlling resources, James says, is how the notion of race got started in the first place and is now why it's still alive today. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
You can follow our Hard Times series at NPR.org and on Twitter at NPR Hard Times. You're listening to NPR News.